This is the Yahoo Sports NBA Podcast, hosted by Chris Mannix. From interviews.
Let's bring in John Wall.
He's Reggie Miller.
Bring in Eric Spoelstra.
To the latest NBA news. To insights you won't get anywhere else.
Rioting is bad. You shouldn't riot.
Past episodes of the podcast can be downloaded in the iTunes Store and Google Play.
Why wouldn't you go back?
Subscribe and leave a rating or comment. Here he is.
Speaking of guys putting their foot in the road.
Chris Mannix.
Yes.
My guest this week, friend of the podcast. You can catch him with me over at Yahoo Sports often. You can see him on NBC Sports Boston, SiriusXM NBA Radio. Eventually, this summer, you'll once again see him in the Big Three. He's Brian Scalabrine. What's up, Scal?
Friend of the podcast, man. I'm the BFF of the podcast, man. Best friends forever.
Really? I got to tell you. Hold on. I got to tell you. I think you have like a warped vision of how many times you do this podcast. Yes, I ask you frequently, but you know, you reject me more than like high school girls did back in the day.
Yeah, we know now that you're not getting rejected very often anymore, especially with the big guests you've been getting lately. So
yeah.
I like to see the way I like to call it is think about it as a player when like the stars would go out, like the coach knew he can count on me to start and we can win some ball games. I could keep this thing afloat when you can't get another guest, but then once you get like your new all-stars or big-time coaches, then you know you can put me back on the bench and you won't hear any complaining from me. But I will always complain about looking for those discounts or something coming my way, because I know, you know, if you start getting some of the all-stars that you get on consistently, then you would definitely want those people would definitely want to get paid by you.
Well, CJ McCollum is coming up later, and you know he did receive a Mattress Firm gift card, and I'll send you one, or I'll just hand you one next time I see you in Boston. And I should point out, Scal, you're also a newly minted 40-year-old, huh?
I am, man. 40. This has been a tough one. Just turning 40. I thought 39 was fine, but you know, I reevaluated my training. I'm like taking it to a new level. So hopefully I can be as good as LeBron is late in his career as, that's what I'm striving for, to play all 82, to bring it. And that's what I'm trying to do in my 40s.
I got to tell you, the best part of Brian Scalabrine turning 40 was the Scal top 10 career plays, video that NBC Boston put together. That was, you had some, I mean, people look at you, I think there's a sort of stereotype about you that you were just like kind of this plodding on the perimeter kind of white guy shooter. You had some hops back in the day, Scal. That sizzle reel, if people haven't seen it, of Scal, that was, you got up back in the day.
No, so it's, I always tell people this. I was a very, very, very poor athlete for an NBA player, but better than everybody else that's not an NBA player. So I was just bad for being in the league. But no, you know, like playing with Jason Kidd obviously helps that. He's dropping dimes to you when you're wide open. Rondo as well. So, yeah, man, I mean, I worked. I maximized my talent. Let's just say that. I was playing at the highest level I possibly could for what God gave me.
No question. All right, let's jump right into it. The top story this week, Scal, is the news that Tyronn Lue of the Cavs is going to step away from the team. Lue announced Monday that he's going to step aside for a bit to deal with health issues. He said he's been dealing with chest pains, a loss of sleep. Some of this sounds kind of eerily similar to what we heard a few months ago when Hornets coach Steve Clifford was going through some health issues of his own. David Aldridge reported that Lue is expected to miss about a week. Larry Drew will coach the team in his absence. How significant to you is the absence, even if it's just for a week, of Tyronn Lue?
So for a week, I would say not that significant. You know, like, get your health right and get ready for the playoffs. I mean, come on, when we watch the Cavs, like they're the, I would say, the most emotionless team I've seen in the NBA. They deal with the media, they talk about it, they act like there's drama there, but there's really not. When they play, they don't necessarily care if a guy scores, if there's a defensive breakdown. There's like no accountability from those guys on the defensive end when you watch them. So I don't think like in right now, I do believe if it led into the playoffs and that first round series, and let's just say right from the jump, things didn't go well in that first round series, then I think, like, you know, a guy being there does matter. But Larry Drew is capable, is a capable coach. But I just think in general, the thing I took away from this more than anything, Chris, is people have no idea the type of stress that these guys go through. It is 24/7. Even when they're sleeping, they're not really sleeping. It's hard to compartmentalize and push these things to the side. Just imagine. And a lot of people would say, oh, well, you're coaching LeBron James. How great is that? But man, there's a lot of stress that comes with that. Your benchmark is the NBA championship or bust. So that's not an easy way to go about it, especially when your team has been struggling this season.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it, as far as it goes with Lou's absence affecting the team, if it is just a week, I think it'll be fine. But if it turns out to be longer, then I think it becomes more significant. Now, if this was the same team that Lou has coached over the last couple of years, I think it would take a little bit less significance. But over the next few weeks, Tyronn Lue is going to have to incorporate returning players like Kevin Love, who just came back, and Tristan Thompson, whose return seems like it's around the corner, in with the new guys like Larry Nance and Jordan Clarkson, and others, guys that have been in that rotation. He's going to have to find, you know, the right mixes with rotations, find the right lineups that work. And, you know, that takes a little bit of time, and that takes a head coach to ultimately do that. Now, what I do think is it puts even more pressure, if it's possible, on LeBron James to be kind of that coach on the floor, to kind of, you know, integrate guys seamlessly while the head coach is out. But I think if it winds up being 2 weeks, you know, 3 weeks or whatever it is, remember Steve Clifford was out for a pretty significant period of time. And not to say they're exactly the same, their issues, but if it turns out to be longer than just a few days, I think it could negatively affect the Cavs going to the playoffs.
Yeah, there is some variable into this, right? Remember, Kevin Love has not played with these guys. Yesterday was his first game, and that's still Larry Nance is out, Rodney Hood is out. So you're exactly right. What is the playoff rotation of this Cleveland Cavalier team? What little tweaks are they going to make to create unguardable lineups? And that's what when you're trying to advance in the playoffs, you're trying to put pressure on the other team and making them, you know, sort of, when they want to go right, you make them go left, but making them go small, or making a guy not being able to stay on the floor using like a Gortat or a Valanciunas. What do you do if they go Kevin Love at the five? Like, there are little tweaks that they haven't even seen the newly acquired Cavs and Kevin Love with LeBron James out there. And a lot of people are saying, oh, I don't think the Cavs have it this year, but you do have to wait. Kevin Love is an absolute stud out there. He spreads the floor. He's good on the post if you switch pick and rolls. So, and when you factor all that in, that is what Ty Lue has to figure out with this Cavs team. Like, what are our playoff rotations going to look like?
So I saw the Cavs play in Portland last week, and you know they're pointing right now to injuries as one of the biggest, if not the biggest, reason that they're struggling. You mentioned Kevin Love just came back, Thompson, Rodney Hood, the back issue, Larry Nance, the hamstring. The Cavs' problems, though, do you look at them as being injury related? That when everybody's healthy, they're going to, you know, be a high level team, or should we look back at what they were when they were healthy, which was a team that could score on anybody, but could be scored from anybody?
Yeah, so I think that I think the biggest guy that I will think will take his game to a whole new level is LeBron James. Just think about what he's been doing. There is a sacrifice to playing 82 games and play 40 minutes a night. And the sacrifice to me is on the defensive end. But now you go into the playoffs, you play, I think, four games in the first, basically over the course of 2 weeks. When you talk about, he probably won't, I don't even know if he'll play 82 this year, but he'll probably take a game off or just play a couple minutes. Then you have that little gap before the playoffs start. Then it's all spaced out because they want to make sure every game's on TV. LeBron, with rest, which is the playoffs, is like no back-to-backs, and you get some rest in between. His defensive level, I think, is going to go to a whole new level, and I think everyone on his team will follow his lead. I know offensively he's been fantastic, and all the, you know, like the normal fans have, like, what more can LeBron do? And I look at them like they're from Mars. I say, well, he could try on defense, and that would make a big difference. That's a switch that he can flip. But once he does flip that switch, and you know LeBron wants to win, and I know he's going to flip that switch on the defensive end, I think the Cavs become a totally different team in the playoffs, and it's going to be comical looking at some of their defensive ratings in the regular season and their defensive rating in the playoffs.
Well, that's the wild card. for me anyway. I mean, when I watched LeBron against Portland, one of the things that stood out was he was magnificent offensively, shooting turnaround jump shots. The dunk on Nurkic was one of the best dunks of LeBron's career, and that says something when he's in year 15. But there were a half dozen possessions, Scal, at least, that he just took it off defensively, you know, where he was just sort of standing around while a defensive play was breaking down, end of quarters, not chasing out on shooters. If you're right, and that level, that defensive level goes up for LeBron in the postseason, they're as dangerous as any team in the East. But if he's still not playing at that high defensive level, I still think they're going to have some problems against some of these upper tier teams. All right.
Let's go on with that, Crispy. Real quick on that one, right? It's embarrassing to watch him on the defensive end.
Yeah.
But do you really believe, like, where in your heart, in your soul, do you really believe that he's not going to flip the switch on the defensive end?
I think he gets better, Scal, but do I think he becomes, you know, all, you know, every playoff game better, every possession for 48 minutes better in the playoffs? I mean, you know, he's probably going to have to play close to 40 minutes. He's already playing 37 per game in the regular season now. He's going to have to play close to 40 for the Cavs to win. Even without the back-to-backs, like you talk about, the long road trips, you think he's going to be able to dial it up every single possession?
Yeah, yeah. I 100% okay. believe that he's going to dial it up every single possession. I have, like, no doubt in my mind that just by him playing defense, not the rest of his guys, like, let's say they all stayed the same, which I think they'll be influenced by him, just by him dialing it up on the defensive end, I believe that this team is and it all comes down to the grueling series that they do or do not have. If they have a cakewalk in the first round, like it is a wrap. They are going to the NBA Finals. If they play a Philly or a Milwaukee and they're in this hotly contested 6-game, 7-game series, then Toronto and Boston do have a chance.
All right, which is going to be a challenge too, because they could sink all the way to 5th, maybe even 6th in the standings, depending on how things shake out the rest of the season. All right, I mentioned Portland, and the Blazers, the hottest team in basketball as we speak, have won 13 games in a row. The backcourt continues to be great. The defense has been really good since the All-Star break. For the first time in Terry Stotts' 6 years in Portland, the Blazers have a top-5 defense right now. Jusuf Nurkić is playing better basketball. We know they're a playoff team, Scal. They have been the last 4 years. They are probably a team that is going to win a first-round series. But are the Blazers a threat to either of the top two teams in the Western Conference?
Yeah, so how it will unfold, like, there's no way. Okay, so in my opinion, there's no way they drop to 4 or 5. So we're looking at their second-round matchup. Like, I like Portland against Houston. I do. I personally like Portland against Houston. I'm like, not the biggest Houston Rocket fan in the playoffs, and I'm not like trying to be a hater or contrarian or anything like that. I just think the playoffs are a little bit different. But with the way that the Warriors are, and I'm assuming that all these injuries are all for naught and they'll be healthy, I don't think they have a chance at beating Golden State. But I would put it, like, Portland's best bet at this point would be just to shut everyone down and see if they can drop to 4 or 5 and, like, roll the balls out against Houston and see if they can get to the Western Conference Finals. Love the team. Love the way they play. Love when they go small ball. Good luck trying to stop these guys that C.J. McCollum and Damian Lillard, who can play on the ball and off the ball, and they do just fine with it. But I always thought with Portland, Nurkic was a great pickup. I always thought they had too many guys, like too many players that were all the same. At this point, their rotations are going to be a little bit tighter. They can go small. They can match up with a lot of different ways. So I like them. I just don't like them against the Warriors.
Yeah, I'm with you as far as beating a Golden State this year or even beating a Houston this year, frankly. The key, though, for them is Nurkic. I mean, when he plays well, they're just a different team. I mean, because you know they can score from their backcourt. You know that even a guy like Evan Turner off the bench is going to be able to make plays for them on both ends. Nurkic, when he's engaged, is a really, really special talent. I saw him against Miami put 27-16 up against the Heat, and the Heat were throwing a bunch of different bodies at him. That was a great Jusuf Nurkić game. A few days later, against Cleveland, he had something like 7-10, and it wasn't even that effective a game, if that makes any sense. I mean, his numbers belied his production. I mean, he just was disengaged, came out in the third quarter, and didn't come back in. This was a game that the Cavs started 6'9" Jeff Green at center. That should have been a game that Nurkic would dominate, at least from the offensive end of the floor. There are just too many times in Portland that this guy kind of just checks out, and they can't afford to have him check out. The margin for error for them against those top teams is non-existent. But if he's playing high level, he's the linchpin to that defense. He's the biggest reason they're a top five defense right now. And if he's playing at a high level, if you can rely on him to give you 15 to 20 points to rebound the basketball, I think they can push Golden State or Houston to 6-7 games. And if things break right, if Lillard continues this MVP level play, it's a small chance, but it's more of a chance than I've given any team out there to beat Golden State the last few years.
Yeah, they do have a chance, and I don't think they'll get swept. I just think when you, at the end of the day, you're talking about a guy who's a sometimes guy in Nurkic, and he's going to at times have to go against an all-everyday guy in Draymond Green in the playoffs. And there's going to be times where he has to match up against Kevin Durant. Like, are you like your chances with them? I get it. Like, those guards are unbelievable, and they'll be able to go shot for shot with Klay and Steph. What higher praise can you give their backcourt? And I love all the stuff that Terry Stotts runs, all the misdirection, the high flare screens, where the floor is completely spaced and you see these guys cutting. I love their offense as well, but the Nurkic against Durant or the Nurkic against Draymond, like, he's not going to win that battle. He just doesn't – he's not built that way. He's not built to sustain – when he's playing bad and those guys are going at him. So can you count on him? Yeah, I think you can count on him against Portland. Against Houston. I'm not putting my money on the line with him against a Draymond Green and a Kevin Durant when they go Death Star lineup.
I tell you, one guy that you and I may have missed on a little bit is Zach Collins. I'm starting to come around, Scal.
Good passer,
On Zach Collins. Good passer. Developing outside shooter, always been a solid rebounder. And I look at his age and where he's at coming out as a freshman at Gonzaga and just being around, you know, some of the players and some of the front office guys in Portland. I know they're supposed to praise their guy. I mean, it doesn't make any sense not to, but there's kind of a palpable giddiness about what Zach Collins can become. And if you look at the last month, you know, fourth quarter minutes, I mean, I think you would agree that the ultimate sign of respect is being trusted in the fourth quarter of games. Fourth quarter minutes, it's Collins and it's Ed Davis. These two guys have developed a real chemistry playing alongside each other. And, you know, it's going to be so important for Portland both this season and moving forward to hit on draft picks. I don't know that Collins is going to be a superstar, but I think at the very least, he is going to be a first big off the bench rotation player. And that's going to be big for the Blazers.
I will say, my whole thing about Zach is, like, physically, he's not an imposing guy.
Right.
Everyone talks about his IQ and his ability to play. Just physically, is he going to be able to dominate that level? This will be good for him. We'll see how he plays in the playoffs when it's as physical as it gets out there. And no matter who you play in Houston, in the Western Conference, whether it's Houston, Golden State, Steven Adams in OKC, whoever you go against, Minnesota and Karl Anthony Towns, just go on down the list. Whoever you go against, it's going to be a beast. So it's going to be interesting how he survives. But, you know, I want him to do well. I just think when you have to, in our business, you have to make a decision on a player. I just think, like, physically, just not gifted enough to play in the league right now.
Yeah, I think this year he's going to have problems in the playoffs. It is going to depend going forward how big he gets, how strong he gets, how he fills out, and how that kind of manifests itself in terms of physicality, rebounding, all that. All right, let me move on to Utah, where I am broadcasting from right now, Scout. Recording this podcast.
I'm sure
from
you had a great time last night. That's spot right there.
I love me some Utah. I mean, give me some Park City all day long. You're going to be out here in a couple weeks. I'll give you a couple spots to check out on the way.
Hey, you do that. Make sure you text me those.
I'll send an Uber for you to go out and get there. The Jazz are one of the best stories in the NBA, though. I mean, 19 and 28 in late January. Since then, they've lost twice. Tell me, as you look at this team and all they've gone through, from the Hayward departure to overcoming a Gobert injury early on, the play of Donovan Mitchell, what's the most impressive thing about Utah's recent run?
Donovan Mitchell and their defense. So I'm going to give 60% of it to Donovan Mitchell, because in the fourth quarter, he's really good. He can carry a team on the offensive end. Also, and then 40% of that, I'll give it to Quinn Snyder and how he just does not beat them. They don't beat themselves. Donovan Mitchell doesn't make mistakes to beat themselves as a rookie, and the team doesn't do it. And everyone understands their role, which is interesting when you're not a team that's in the playoffs where you got people making sacrifices left and right. for all these guys to make the sacrifices for Donovan Mitchell to become what he is, and then for Quinn Snyder to keep these guys accountable on the defensive end, that's where the credit goes. He is a much better coach than I thought. I thought his slow down style of play, it was eventually going to be the demise of him, but he's sort of like, I don't know, like opened it up to Donovan Mitchell to make plays, which I never thought he would. I always thought he was a little bit too controlling. So I'll give both those guys a lot of credit. And Utah is the one team that's really messing it up for everybody else, because these other teams that are fighting for the playoffs, they thought, oh yeah, we're a shoo-in. You can't count Utah in this year. But no, they've been amazing over the past, what do you call it, 6 weeks in this, in the season.
I love what Utah's doing, because in mid-January, they very easily could have said, you know what, screw it. We need another top player as we kind of build this thing out post-Gordon Hayward. They could have said to Rudy Gobert, you know, Rudy, take another month off. Take a month and a half off. Really rest that knee, and we'll kind of live to fight another year, so to speak. But they didn't. They brought Gobert back. And Gobert, he might not win Defensive Player of the Year this season because of the number of games he missed, but you're going to be hard-pressed to find more impactful defensive players. I mean, look at the numbers. I mean, Gobert came back at the tail end of that struggling stretch for them in late January. And really since then, if you look at February into March, they have been a different team. He just changes the identity of a team defensively and just single-handedly improves them in that way. I mean, he has been a remarkable talent for them. And you mentioned Donovan Mitchell. You know, Ben Simmons gets a lot of respect for Rookie of the Year, and he should. And I know Ben Simmons right now, I've heard you say it, and I've seen you in print saying it, but Ben Simmons is considered the front runner for Rookie of the Year. What chance do you give Donovan Mitchell of overtaking him before the end of the season?
A lot. And I'll tell you why, because I think a lot of people, when it's this close of a race, will lean towards Donovan Mitchell because he didn't play last year, or he wasn't on the NBA roster last year. I think the biggest thing about being a rookie is not just your play on the floor, which matters, right? Like how you respond to that. Another thing now is like the impact of winning. Clearly he's impacting winning more than anybody thought he did. And Ben Simmons, you can say the same thing about, but you know, like he does have Joel Embiid, who's also healthy this year. So you can factor in Philly's success to that. But it's also adjusting to life outside of college. It's understanding what 82 games is and going through that. Like Ben Simmons had like a free trial run where Donovan Mitchell is like learning on the fly. So I think that people, like I would, if I had a vote, I would be Simmons, Mitchell, Tatum. But I think a lot of people look at it and say, yeah, but like if it's this close and Simmons was there all last year and he got a chance to sit out, I'm going to vote for Mitchell because of it. So I think this would probably be the closest Rookie of the Year race we had in a long, long time. And I think that he will, I think he might edge him out just if they continue to play the way they've been playing. Going back to what you said earlier, since January 24th, they've lost two, like right now, just off the top of your head, the two hottest teams of the NBA are Portland is one and Houston's the other, right? Mm-hmm. So since January 24th, Utah lost two games. Guess who they lost to?
I know Portland was one, right?
And Houston was the other one. That's it. I mean, you're talking about going on a stretch here where you're losing to two big-time teams. And, you know, like in the NBA, you know how it is. You drop a game to in Atlanta. I can't believe we lost this game. It was a scheduling loss. Utah has been on a tear losing to only the hottest teams in the NBA, and they're winning convincingly most nights. So I think just because of that, and Donovan Mitchell is their best player, and he usually leads the team in scoring, Donovan Mitchell might edge out Simmons. And I would still vote Simmons, but I thought there would be no chance that he will win it. He is making this a very, very compelling Rookie of the Year race.
Yeah, and you mentioned Quinn Snyder, too. Quinn Snyder, I've said this before, and I'll say it again, one of the best developmental coaches in the NBA. If you look at the young guys that Quinn Snyder has gotten his hands on, that have just developed into stars. I mean, you know, Hayward in Boston now, he developed under Quinn Snyder. Gobert, now Donovan Mitchell, Rodney Hood. So the list is long and growing of guys that have succeeded under Quinn Snyder. One thing I'd point out, too, about Mitchell, that I see it sometimes a lot from people that maybe don't watch a lot of Jazz games. And I'm not going to sit here and say I watch every Jazz game. I don't. But, you know, I hear the narrative sometimes with Mitchell is that, well, he's surging in the second half. That's just not true. Like, Mitchell in his fourth game of his career, had 19 points. In his sixth game, he had 22. He averaged 18 in November, and since then, Scal, he's averaged at least 20 points per game in every month that he's played, including this month when he's right around 22 points per game. He has been consistent from day one as a scorer. It's a deeper conversation about how the hell he's become a scorer. This is a guy in college that never cracked 30 points per game, but for whatever reason, the NBA game suits him, the Jazz system suits him, and he has been consistent really from day one of the season.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the only thing that's happening more is like everyone on Utah realizing that the kid is special and Quinn Snyder just going to him more than he did before. But he's not just a guy that jacks up shots. He's got a lot of Dwayne Wade in his game with that high pick and roll, but Probably a better pull-up jump shooter. D-Wade's probably a better finisher in getting contact. But definitely, this kid's going to be one of the best players in this draft. This draft is turning out to be a really good draft. And that's including the number one pick, not even playing a game or playing two games or whatever he did in Markelle Fultz. So I like watching him play. He's tough. You can just tell, like, the skill level of players now are so much better coming in than it was, say, 5-10 years ago.
Everyone knows how important stretching is before an event. So does Mattress Firm, except it's your dollar. Your budget stretches further when you're shopping in America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a true home run, and you'll have a ball. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise, but know this. They are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed, from adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor. They have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast to see what deals are happening as I read this sentence to you. They even offer you a 120 sleep night trial to ensure perfection and 120 night low price guarantee so you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch, a knockout, if you will. Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow.
All right, let me finish in our backyard there, Boston, where injuries are starting to pile up for the Celtics. Kyrie Irving out with a sore knee. Daniel Tice out for the season with a knee injury. Marcus Smart out for 6 to 8 weeks with a thumb injury. A couple other guys dealing with minor bumps and bruises, including Jaylen Brown, who is still sidelined with that concussion. As you look down kind of the walking wounded of the Celtics, Scal, I mean, what's the most significant injury that Boston has to be worried about going into the postseason?
So that's a good question. That has two answers, right? If Kyrie is doing this for maintenance, and I kind of assume that he is, because like I don't feel, like when you're walking around an organization, you have a conversation about an injury. There's like a different level of stress you feel when people are really worried about it. I don't think that the Celtics are worried about Kyrie long term. I think it's like more of a short term, manage the minutes. You know, the Celtics are kind of locked into that second seed. So it's all about like, what can Kyrie do to move on? So eliminate, which is probably Kyrie's knee is the most important thing you should worry about, like a knee versus a Marcus Smart thumb. But Smart not being able to play in the first and maybe half the second round of the playoffs will be the biggest loss for the Celtics. His defensive versatility is something that they cannot replicate out there. It's just his instincts of making winning plays, the way that he's been playing offensively since returning from the initial incident. The one thing is they're used to playing without him. I just think in the playoffs, when everything becomes like up a notch, he's the guy that I do not worry about that's going to be able to bring it, take on a certain matchup in the playoffs. So Smart is the one that really got me down. Tice, I thought, there's going to be a time, but they can go Al Horford at the five if they needed to. But Marcus Smart being out, I just hope that he can come back and the Celtics can still be alive in the playoffs when he gets back.
Yeah, I'm with you on Smart because, I mean, the 6-7 games after the All-Star break that Smart played in coming back from the other injury, they were a different team. He just changes the identity defensively. And as much as I like what Terry Rozier brings on both ends and, they've extracted something out of Shane Larkin, nobody provides the type of defensive energy that Marcus Smart does, and his willingness and ability to defend really four positions at times. I mean, it seems like, Scal, to me that when he winds up on a switch on a power forward or a center, he loves it. Like he wants a guy to try to post him up.
Not a mismatch.
And bang with him, and it's rarely a mismatch unless you have a big, strong, low-bodied or strong lower-body big man. I don't know how they overcome that. Now, maybe they can win a first-round series, probably can, without Marcus Smart, but you get into the second round, and you're talking Cleveland, you're talking Toronto. I just don't see it. I think Smart's absence is going to be significant. That, and that, of course, puts aside the obvious that Kyrie Irving is the most significant one out there. But you mentioned Al Horford. And Al Horford, for people outside of Boston listening to this podcast, is a pretty maligned guy at times in Boston. Seems like there's a faction of media and Celtics fans that want Horford to be maybe more than he is. They want him to score, you know, be a 20-10 type of guy, or at least put up better numbers than he's put up really since the All-Star break. Do you think the Celtics need more from Al Horford over these final few weeks and into the playoffs?
So you got to. I think you need to separate that question out.
Okay.
The final few weeks, maybe not. Right? Do they really need anything from anybody when they have a 6-game lead in the loss column?
Still got to be careful, though, don't you? I mean, I know it's a big lead, but I don't think it's insurmountable if these injuries kind of pile up for Boston. I think they could go on a pretty nasty skid if they don't get some bodies back.
Nah, man, Phoenix. Sacramento coming
that's
up.
That's true.
They still got Brad Stevens.
But you got to go to Portland, and you got to go to Utah.
Sacramento. Yeah. So yeah, it's just like, I don't think they're going to, I just don't think they're going to fall. I just don't. So do, but here's what they do. Here's the Al Horford narrative. Here's, if I have, and you know, like I'm like Al Horford's biggest fan. I am. Mm-hmm. So if I have one gripe with Al, and I've also said, and I give him unbelievable credit for giving the game what it needs, right? But when he starts out the game and he has he's aggressive Al, you know, active Al, whatever other adjective you want to use, I would say that's when he is really good. Like that's when you could definitely tell he's just the Celtics need him. He provides so much for the team. My issue would just be when he starts out the game as like passive Al, looking to get everyone involved, right? I never understand because what it's like to be a great player and have the ability to at any point like turn it on the way he does. But when he starts out the game and he's not active and he's not like looking to be aggressive, why can't he like turn that on in the second half? And that would be it. Like it seems like however he starts the game is how that day is going to be. You know what I wish that he could, okay, today I'm going to get the teammates involved. Okay, you know what? These guys aren't good. They're not. They don't have it today. You know what? I'm going to inject some serious energy into this third quarter. You guys get on my back. I'm going to carry you guys to the third quarter. Now, that doesn't mean I'm going to take every shot. It just means he's going to play like we've seen him play at certain times. I don't understand why sometimes the narrative starts out a certain way where he's active and aggressive and it carries on, and other days he's not. And I would believe, as great of a player as he is, that he can flip that switch anytime. I've seen other great players do that, but he just seems to not do that. So that's my only gripe with him. But my guess is throughout the playoffs, he'll be that guy. You know, it's time to focus in. He was after those first two games against Chicago last year, and when they were down 0-2, he became like a totally different animal out there, and he was really good for the rest of the playoffs. So I'm assuming he'll do that. I just don't know if it's as important right now. And Al does know how to navigate a season. He gets the 82 game grind.
Yeah, two things I would like to see from Al. One is the defensive rebounding numbers be a little bit better and continue to be a strength for him. That's not always been a strength. You go back to his days in Atlanta when more physical teams came to play the Hawks, and I'm using Cleveland as an example because Tristan Thompson gobbled him up a lot back in those days. I'd like to see him improve those defensive rebound numbers. And offensively, just exploit mismatches when they're there. I'll use Portland, who the Celtics are playing on Friday, as an example. If Al winds up spending time at the five, and he's got Jusuf Nurkić across from him, Nurkić is the type of guy that can be rattled. Like, you can take Nurkić out of the game mentally if you go at him and draw him into foul trouble. I'd love to see, and I know Boston's not isolation-heavy offense, but go to Horford, you know, midway through the shot clock, and let him take a guy like Nurkić off the dribble if that's the matchup. Just when he sees bigger bodies in front of him, go at them, you know, dribble around them, score, shoot those fall away jump shots. Just be more proactive on the offensive end of the floor when he's got a matchup that looks like he can exploit.
Yeah, and I think that most nights he has that matchup, to be honest with you, Chris.
Yeah.
Rarely does he play against a guy that has the versatility that can guard him. So that to me is screen, pop, get it, swing it, screen, pop, drive it, kick it. Like when he's doing that he never took a shot during that little sequence I just described. Mm-hmm. When he's doing that, the Celtics are like really tough to beat. But other nights, it's like, should I shoot this? Should I not? Should I move it? Should I not? I know when he's at his best, the Celtics are at their best. Now, I just don't think it matters from now until the rest of the season. They got 12 games remaining. I think for him, it's just about being healthy, being rested, being ready to go right from the start to be a 40-minute a game. Or maybe it's not that. It's 35 minutes a game of all out. Like, you know why I'm hard to guard? Because I could pop. I could shoot. I could put it on the floor. I can make a good decision. So when the defense collapses, I can dump off. If you switch, you put a small on me, I can take you down low. That's why he's tough to stop. You just got to have that throughout the playoffs.
Yeah. Well, Scout, we're like two ships passing in the night there. As I leave Portland and Utah, you head out to Portland.
When are you coming back to Boston? We're going to do another game together.
I'm on the red eye Tuesday night, but you're on a West Coast swing, man. We're
you coming back for the college stuff?
No, I'm just coming back because I've been on the West Coast for too long and I need to, you know, breathe a little bit.
So I thought guys like you just can live anywhere, like vagabond, right? You have nothing to come home to.
That sounds so depressing.
No, I can say it the other way. You got a lot of pieces to come home to. Like me, I got three kids and one person to come home to.
You also have many people to come home to. How many appearances do you have set up for this road trip?
It's hard for me to get appearances on the road. I do have like a one major thing I'm doing in Seattle before Portland. I'm like Mr. Appearance back here.
Yeah, that's true.
Not when I'm on the road.
That's true. I'm sure we're not staying at the same hotels, but I'll leave some restaurant recommendations for you out there.
Yeah, send a text. I'd like to go out and have some fun in Utah.
Scout, always appreciate it, man. Thanks for joining me.
You got it.
Support for this podcast, as always, comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They understand that home plays a big role in your life and family. That's why they created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, with Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. It's convenient. Our trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. And in addition to getting a real mortgage approval in minutes, you can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you're getting the right solution for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/Mannix, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030.
All right, my guest this week is CJ McCollum, one of the NBA's top guards, playing for one of the hottest teams in the league. And I learned something new about CJ being out here the last few days. One of the most rabid Browns fans I've ever come across. And that's just, you know, Canton, Ohio, right? That comes from childhood.
Yeah. It's in my blood, man. Mm-hmm. I've been a Browns fan since day one. And obviously, we haven't had a lot of success, so you know that my loyalty is strong. Mm-hmm. I've been through a lot of unfortunate seasons, forgettable seasons, 0-16. But one of the most memorable seasons would be our 8-8, 9-7 years. You know, Jamal Lewis was in town, and I think we had Matt Hassel back as well. Mm-hmm. So we've been up and down a lot, and I think the tide is turning. New GM in place, and pre-free agency, things are going well. And then with a look, possibly signing Tyrann Mathieu, who's a free agent who's just been released from the Cardinals. So if we can get him, continue to build. We just signed Carlos Hyde, former Buckeye. Things are looking right.
Do you go to a lot of games as a kid?
I went to a few. Mm-hmm. I went to a few games as a kid. More so Indians games than Browns games, just because of the fact that, you know, it was cold and raining and we weren't very good, so I'd rather watch on TV.
Do you still watch that on TV out here?
I live stream a lot of the games online. I have made the mistake of getting Comcast. No offense to Comcast, but there's only NFL Red Zone. So I only see my Browns when we're getting scored on.
Yeah. I mean, it's got to be tough being a Browns fan the last couple of years. I mean, how do you keep the faith?
Test your patience, but it's a roller coaster ride. And you understand that the guys are trying to win, the organization is trying to win. It's just not working in our favor right now. And I always jokingly say, you know, this is the year I'm going to buy a jersey that doesn't have my name on the back. You know, I usually customize it and put McCollum on the back. Mm-hmm. But this year, you know, if we make the right decisions in this draft, I could see myself getting maybe a Landry jersey or potentially the number one pick. Mm-hmm. Barkley.
But see, this is where the Browns fans go off course, man. Like, you once again are willing to pass on a quarterback at number one. I know you got number four, you can take one there. Yeah. But you know that if you pass on a QB at one, two and three, someone's going to take a quarterback there, and it's going to be a great quarterback. It's just the Browns' luck.
It always happens to us. But here's the thing. We've struck out so many times at quarterback. I think it's this time you take the for sure prospect because mm-hmm. these quarterbacks are good, but it's not surefire. It's not a surefire Carson Wentz in this draft. You're not mm-hmm. you're not sure what's going to happen. There's not a Deshaun Watson in this draft. They could be better, could be worse, but there's no certainties. But what's for certain is that Saquon Barkley can do a lot of things out of the backfield, and he can catch the ball out of the backfield and mm-hmm. relieve the pressure of a quarterback who we just signed in Tyshawn Taylor. So mm-hmm. I feel like you know what Tyshawn Taylor is going to do. He can manage a game. He's not going to make many mistakes, high completion rate, and he has a body of work up to this point to where with a rookie running back and some guaranteed, you know, 1,000-yard receivers and Josh Gordon and Landry, I think that we have those pieces there. So you build around running back, mm-hmm. receiver, worry about the quarterback later, or you draft at four. But I think you take running back, take a DB, and get a quarterback later on. Mm-hmm. Maybe you go after Baker later on or someone mm-hmm. of that nature.
First Browns playoff game, and you have an off day out here. Are you there?
Depending on where it's at. I said we go to the Super Bowl. I would be willing to miss a game to go
watch. No matter what, I think that's fair. If you're a lifelong Browns fan, you've gone through what you've gone through. You should be willing to miss a January, February regular season game.
I mean, I would seriously consider it, or I would just have to leave right after the game and get into the city and miss practice the mm-hmm. next day.
This team in Portland, the last 3 years, I mean, one of the few certainties in the NBA is that this team plays well in the second half of the season. I know you're asked this a lot, but does this season feel the same, different? I mean, is there similarities, differences to the way you're playing now versus the last couple of years?
I think there's some similarities in the fact that we performed extremely well post All-Star break the last 2 years, and this being the third straight year of essentially 60-65% wins mm-hmm. Post All-Star break. But I think the way we're winning is a lot different. You know, defensively, top five, top seven team in the NBA, second defensive rating overall since All-Star break, defensive efficiency. Offensively, you know, not as sharp as we were in past years, but we're still top 15 offensive team. I just think that, you know, in the fourth quarters, we're executing a lot better than we have in previous years, maintaining our defensive principles, getting stops, preventing second-chance opportunities. And the fact that we're on a 10-game winning streak shows that we're playing well, probably a little bit better than we have in previous years.
Mm-hmm. You had – one of the things that surprised me to start the year was that you guys brought 12 guys back. You had a softish schedule to start the season, mm-hmm. and you didn't just come out as fast as I thought you might have. Did it surprise you that this team didn't come bursting out of the gates after the way you finished last year?
Yeah, I would like to see us start better, but historically we've been – slow. Mm-hmm. We started off slow. We've had some injuries to key positions, to versatile guys like Chief. He's gotten hurt the last 2 years at the beginning of the season where he misses 15 to 17 games early mm-hmm. on, and he's underrated and undervalued in the fact that we need him. He's versatile. He's able to guard multiple positions. He's shooting three a lot better. And you take a jack-of-all-trades guy out like that, and that hurts our defense. And then mm-hmm. Dame got hurt early on in the season. Some other guys, ET, faced some injuries, and I think that messed up our chemistry a little bit. But not to make excuses, we just started off poorly. However, we started off better than we did the last few years, to where we were battling 10 games under 500 at the break. We were 4 or 5 games over 500 and knew that we were going to make that push the second half of the season.
Last year, it was the Nurk trade that kind of served as a flashpoint to everything that happened in the second half. Mm-hmm. Was there a turning point this year, you know, something that clicked for you guys? I know Ed Davis told me recently the Golden State win from about a month or so ago was a turning point, he thought, for him.
Yeah, I think the Golden State win right before the All-Star break was a total game that we played, you know, defensively. Obviously, KD had 50, but we made it tough on him. Steph and Clay off the line as much as we could, just try to make it difficult. Move the ball. We pushed the ball in transition, you know, continue to attack and put pressure on the defense. And I think we got enough stops down the stretch to where it was a good momentum win heading into the break, understanding how close the Western Conference race was going to be. And then understanding that we did have a softer schedule than some of the other teams in the NBA. But there's no easy outs, as mm-hmm. you've seen across the NBA. You never know who's going to get hot from a game-to-game basis. But I think overall, considering how we started six losses in a row at home mm-hmm. to 15 out of his last 16, 16 of our last 17 at home, we've completely did a 180.
Nurk's an interesting guy. It seems like tough love is how this team treats him, from Terry to, and Dame was talking about it recently, how he tries to be pretty blunt with Nurk on in some of his criticism. As a leader yourself, how do you approach a guy like Nurkic and trying to help him get to that level?
I think just continuing to follow coach's approach, explaining to him how important he is to our team. Mm-hmm. I told him we'll go as far as he goes. It's not about what Dame does, not about what I do. And we will go as far as you take us from an interior standpoint. Presence, being in the paint, showing your body on defense, finishing around the basket, you know, being able to set great screens and make good reads once they're trapping our ball screens, and continue to stay locked in. I think he understands, you know, how important he is to our team. I think he understands that, you know, him his play post All-Star break, you know, 54-55% from the field, you know, points are up, rebounds are up over 10 a game. And we need that Nurk every night, not the Nurk that's, you know, doing flip shots and and, you know, not always paying attention and not locked in the way he should be. And I think that he's done a great job of responding to us, you know, coming at him sometimes in a nice way, sometimes in a, hey, man, this is how things need to be type of way.
What's the not-so-nicest way you've come at him?
A lot of curse words. I think last game I told him, that's the most I've seen you dunk since last year. So just like, you know, a little jab so he understands, like, look, we know what you're capable of. You showed us what you're capable of. So anything less than that is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. It's one thing, you know, to miss shots. That's cool. But it's another thing to lack of effort, not dunking the ball when you could dunk it. Those are the things that you can control. You can't control missed free throws. That's going to happen, missed jumpers. But you can control dunking and not dunking.
And the game against Miami was kind of proof that, you know, when he's on, he's tough.
Right.
I mean, he's a two-way player.
Right, and the funny part is that he left points on the board. Mm-hmm. You know, he may have missed five shots, but the five shots he missed were, you know, bunny putback. He gets the rebound, misses a putback, or he spins off of a guard. The big doesn't jump, and he smokes a layup. But that efficiency that he had, although he missed five layups or whatever it was, he still was, I don't know, 13 for 17, 13 for 18 from the field, and controlled the entire game. 16 rebounds, blocked shots at the rim, and just kind of dominated that entire game.
You've spent the last 3 years, and you've been one of the best, like I said, one of the best guards in the league. Your number's right at around 20 points per game. In what areas do you think that you've been able to layer stuff onto your game over the last couple of years? What have been kind of points of emphasis for you?
I think just defensively continuing to get better. Dame and I have spoken about it. We spoke about our coaches. The more locked in we are, the better we are on the defensive end in terms of being engaged, understanding the team's personnel, you know, knowing when to chase versus when to shoot the gap versus, you know, when to go under. The intensity and focus we bring on that end will translate to wins for us. And I think we've done that, you know, being a top seven, top 10 defensive team. Obviously, guys are going to score at times because guys are so good. But I think that's been a big focus offensively, you know, trying to balance hitting the roller versus hitting the roll replace guy. And I try to get to the free throw line a little bit more. But overall, I think that, you know, it's been a good year and we're continuing to try to build.
How would you describe your relationship with Dame? I guess in the context of first year together versus now, how has that relationship evolved?
Well, we were friends before we got to the NBA. I had reached out through a mutual friend that connected us and just kind of asked him about the process of being in the NBA, you know, work ethic standpoint.
People love that word, process.
Yeah, I mean,
it's the most famous NBA word out there now.
It's huge just because a lot of times things don't go your way right away. Maybe you're going through injuries, maybe, you know, you're in a rebuild, and just continue to ask him about it and how I can improve. And then, you know, once I got here my rookie year, obviously I wasn't playing, I was hurt and trying to rehab and trying to get on the court. And I just kind of watching him, working out with him, you know, getting to know him a little bit better, understanding that, you know, he would always say it's going to be me and you in the backcourt, you know, so just keep working, understand that it may not be happening right now, but eventually it's going to. And I think our relationship has continued to evolve. We understand each other a lot better on the court. I think that stems because of our relationship off of it. In terms of the trust, holding each other accountable, being able to make those reads where there's nothing said, you kind of look at each other and you understand. You know, all right, I'm going this way, you're going that way. Look for me on the roll or place, or I'm going to feel behind on this pick and roll. I know they're going to trap you, and I'm going to knock it down, or I'm going to get the ball to the other side and kind of free things up for you.
How was your, you know, those first couple of years, I think it was like the last 20, 25 games, your second year that you really started to kind of rise a little bit. I mean, coming from a mid-major type of school and not getting, not things not working out right away in that first year and a half, was it easy to, how was it to keep the confidence that you can play at that level?
It was tough, honestly. I had been through so much, you know, going back to school my senior year, fracturing my foot, you know, 13 games into my senior year career over. Come back into the NBA, last day of training camp, I fractured my same foot again. So then you start to have the doubts and the why me's and the, you know, the woe is me. You feel sorry for yourself. And
foot injuries, as scary as they seem, you know, on the outside, seems like the foot's become the new really scary injury.
It's one of the scariest things because you go from actively moving around, jumping, running, cutting, to not being able to walk. So then you start to think like, wow, like how am I going to come back from this? Like I can't walk. I can't walk up the stairs. I can't sit on the toilet, like sitting on the toilet, you know what I mean? Like the things you take for granted, taking a shower in a chair, like all that, that was me. So you go through that and you're like, man, I go from the highest point in my life to can't even walk, can't barely put my jeans on, I had to wear sweatpants. So it's a very frustrating process, but once you get through it, it makes you stronger. And having gone through it the first time in college, I understood the process, I understood the rehab, and knew how to kind of manipulate my mind to where, like, you have to overcome this. But the bummer was the second year I come back, I started to get in rotation, then I fractured my index finger on my shooting hand, and then we trade for Anafalo. And I was like, oh, here we go again. And suddenly, you know, we're winning, things are going well, we're on pace to win, I don't know, 54, 53 games, and Wes tears his Achilles, and then Aaron hurts his shoulder. So next thing you know, I get eight DMPs in a row to starting. And then we're playing against Memphis Grizzlies in the first round of the playoffs, and we're going against Tony Allen. So it was just a roller coaster of emotions and a challenging time for me, but I just worked. I just worked and told myself that, you know, my mom would always say, you don't blow an opportunity by not playing. You blow it by not being ready to play when you get an opportunity. And I just tried to get as ready as possible so that when they did throw me out there, I would sink and continue to show that I was worthy of that number 10 pick.
You mentioned Dame's support of you in the early on. How big was that for helping your confidence stay afloat while you were going through all the injury issues early on?
No, that was big. You know, he kind of empowered me because I wasn't able to play. You know, they seen what I was capable of in practice, but it's not the same as performing in the game. So, you know, Neil and all those guys in the front office knew what I was capable of because they had seen me go through an entire summer. They seen me go through workouts, and my approach, you know, is the same. But just not being able to play, being hurt, and kind of having those setbacks put you in a little box to where the clock starts ticking. As a lottery pick, you get a few years, and if you don't pan out, you get labeled. And I just didn't want to, I wanted the label to be appropriate for my game and who I am as a player, not based on injuries.
When you look at what you still can be, because you're still a young guy in this league playing with another great guard, what do you see as the things you can be down the line? What kind of individual goals do you set for yourself?
Yeah, I think I just try to be as consistent as possible. I think that the individual goals are aligned with winning. The more you win, the more success you have as an individual. So whether that be making an All-Star game or making an All-NBA, or whatever the case may be, that comes from team success. So, you know, winning 50 games, consistently getting out of the first round of the playoffs. You know, if we do those things, that means I'm playing well, for starters. That means individually I'm playing well. I'm helping my team win. The numbers are there. I'm shooting well from three, getting to the line and keeping my teammates involved. And, you know, winning kind of triumphs everything for me. So at some point I hope to get to that 90-50-40, you know, a little ways away right now. missed too many free throws, missed some easy bunnies this year. But I'd say that in the next 3 years I'd like to be at 50-40-90, you know, 50 wins multiple years, you know, in advance into the Western Conference Finals and trying to contend for a championship.
It feels like you guys have kind of changed the narrative on what a backcourt should be in some ways. I mean, you know, 10, 15 years ago was you got to have a 6'1" point guard and a 6'6" two guard. And that's kind of how a team is built. You guys have come along over the last 5-6 years and really changed the dynamic to the point where I don't think teams look as much anymore. I mean, Donovan Mitchell's a good example. I don't think teams look as much anymore at height as being a true detriment to being a consistent two guard.
Right. I think it's just important if you're a basketball player. Can you play? Can you make plays for others? And if you have a basketball IQ and you can shoot, dribble, pass, I think there's a role for you somewhere on any team. If they have to respect your ability to play in the pick and roll, can you break down your man in isolation situations late in the shot clock? And the fact that, you know, 40-plus three-point shooter, you know, Dame shooting extremely well from three, has range up to half court, and we can both play on and off the ball and be interchangeable, I think that dynamic makes it tough for us to be guarded. And people talk about the height factor. It's like, look, you know, I'm 6'3", 6'4", Dame 6'3", 6'4", who knows how close we are to 6'4". I'm probably a little bit closer. But the fact of the matter is that we're being productive. Our team's top 10 in defense this year. We've historically been a top 10 offensive team, and we're contending, you know, for 50 wins this season. What more do you want from your backcourt? Like, I mean, if they're 6'6" and 6'7" and not as productive, does it really matter?
You mentioned Dame range at half court. That's not hyperbole either. Like, there are times that he pulls up like maybe 4 feet inside that half court line, just maybe to see if he's got that range there that night.
Yeah, he says that he doesn't notice how far he is sometimes. I'm like, look, just take a step. Sometimes I tell him, look, bro, just sometimes take that extra dribble in and it makes the shot easier. But he says he doesn't feel a difference until he sees it on film. You know, he kind of just plays. And obviously, you know, we look sometimes and we're like, yo, you were mad far on that last three. Like, you know how far you were. And he's like, look, I feel them sitting down in a stance and backing up, and I just raise up.
When Dame requested that meeting with Paul Allen and had it, how did you take that?
I took it as him, you know, taking a step forward and trying to figure out, you know, the progress and the type of decisions we're trying to make for the future of the organization. And, you know, he filled me in on some of the stuff they discussed and kind of what the plans were moving forward. And, you know, obviously, Mr. Allen and our front office and our organization has done a tremendous job of continuing to try to not only develop talent but acquire talent these past few years. And I think you know, we're heading in the right direction. You know, 10-game winning streak, trying to ride the wave and continue to get better, understanding that as good as we've played, you know, the tide could turn, and we are 4 games away from being in 10th spot. Mm-hmm. So we got to continue to win and not drop 2 games in a row.
Before you knew the details of what happened, when you heard about the meeting, or however you heard about it, mm-hmm. did it worry you at all that maybe he's, you know?
Nah, I mean, I wasn't worried. It's just because I understand the status quo, and mm-hmm. I understand how secure our organization is in terms of, you know, looking after players, taking care of us, making sure that they run a player-first organization. And knowing Dame and working with him every day, I understood that. I think it was kind of blown out of proportion. Mm-hmm. You know, we have an open door policy with all of our staff and personnel. So mm-hmm. I thought that they kind of blew it up and made it bigger than what it actually was.
Media doesn't do that. What are you talking about? That never happens. Yeah. one of the things I thought watched from the outside was during the draft and looking at a guy like Zach, and given that the team moved up to go get him and the cap situation here, like he had to hit. Like you had to find a player in Zach, and it looks like he can play. I mean, it looks like he's going to be able to play in this league. For you, when did you notice that he could be, you know, a player not just down the line, but maybe as early as this year?
I mean, honestly, I don't watch college basketball like I used to anymore, so I had no idea who he was until we got here. I had seen a few Big Ten games because of ET loves Ohio State, obviously, so I watched Biggie play a little bit, but. Overall, I had no idea who either of them were as people or players. And the first couple of days I got in, I seen his basketball IQ. I seen the touch, his ability to kind of challenge shots at the rim, and he has great footwork. And then I said, how old is he? And like, he's 19. I was like, oh, he's going to be a monster. Mm-hmm. You know, he's going to be extremely talented. He's already a very good talent. He's going to have a long career. His versatility and his skill set for a 7-footer to only be 19, never started. Didn't start in high school. Didn't start in college. People don't know that. He's picking up the game at an extremely high rate. He works hard. He wants to be great. He's tough. And I think his ability to shoot translates right now. His footwork, his ability to contest shots in the lane, switch and guard multiple positions. And this is 60-something games into his NBA career. Mm-hmm. So the sky's the limit. He's going to put on some more weight. The game's going to slow down for him, and he's going to continue to find his niche and figure out ways he can impact the game. And I think he's going to be a problem.
Guys just keep getting younger and younger, don't they?
Yeah, man, it's great. I told somebody the other day, I said, yeah, I feel sorry for some of these kids. You know, you come in at 18, 19, living in L.A. and Miami, and I can only imagine how I would have been at 18 or 19, you know, as a young, you know, NBA player.
Hard to figure it out, man. Like, yeah. I mean, you had at least the 4 years of college and coming
right.
in with a maturity
and
level.
You're still not ready. After 4 years, you come out, and there's just some things that you have to experience in the NBA to be prepared for, whether that be the financial understandings of financial advisors, investing in the stock market, balancing a portfolio, or managing your body. Like, you try to figure out trial and error because you're used to managing your body for 30 games. Mm-hmm. Now you're managing it for 82. So training in the summertime, when do you rest? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff you just kind of learn on the fly.
What's an example of trial and error that you've used over the years?
I just worked as hard as possible and did as much as I could to where I started to ask the staff, like, hey, like, how's my body holding up statistically with the numbers? How's the impact, the stress, the miles I'm logging? And then just kind of based on how I feel. But I just try to do as much as possible, whether that be recovery stuff, acupuncture, steam room, ice baths, cold tub, masseuse, Normatec float, to working out. Try a 40-minute workout after practice. All right, that's too long. All right, 30. Still, it's kind of too long. 25, 20. Find the sweet spot to where you're getting productive work in, but not, you know, wearing yourself out. Because then you go play the game and you're like, okay, I think I did too much yesterday, so now I'm going to tone it down a little bit. So that's what I mean by trial and error. You just go through the process of some games you might be a little sore because you lifted 3 days in a row. And you wanted to see, you know, how your body was going to respond.
Are you and Dame, have you found the ideal chemistry for playing together? There's still things that you're getting better at playing together.
Yeah, I think our chemistry is great right now, but there's always ways to improve, whether that be eye contact stuff, whether that be situational, continuing to figure out, you know, what plays each we both like. You know, we're at a point now to where this is my 5th year, his 6th year, but this is my 3rd year as a full-time starter. So, you know, you're looking at, before the break, I had played, 322 career games. Mm-hmm. So continue to try to log games and get that experience and continue to break down film to where we can figure out ways to make each other more productive.
Do you still feel that push that, you know, that kind of like I'm a guy coming from the mid-major, people still might doubt me. Do you still get that even though feel that you've been so consistent the last few years?
Yeah, I just try to prove myself wrong. I think I'm my biggest critic, my family. You know, we're more anal in terms of you know, greatness, chasing greatness, chasing efficiency, stop missing free throws, stop turning the ball over, figuring out ways to become more effective. And, you know, regardless of what people say about my game or how they pick me apart or praise me, you know, there's nothing they can say that my mom or dad hasn't already told me about my game and how I need to improve and how I need to continue to, you know, stay consistent, continue to help our team win. And I think it just comes from the underground, the underdog mentality coming from Canton, Ohio, to Midwest, no scholarship offers until, you know, my first career start as a junior. I didn't have a scholarship offer until that junior season ended. You know, going into my senior season, you know, committing and signing to Lehigh, to going to Lehigh, no one knows who I am, and getting drafted, and then they say, like, he doesn't have a position, he's this, he's that, you know, he can't ever be efficient in the NBA because he shoots his, the shots are too difficult, to he can't make people around him better, to he can't guard his position, to he can't win. There's always something, and then to the point to where you just try to be the best version of you. You know, people hating on LeBron and Mike, and he's arguably the best players ever, so they're going to definitely hate on you, so you just got to convince yourself that, you know, your work ethic and your approach is enough, and you live with the result every day.
Easy adjustment, the lifestyle of Portland coming from Ohio?
Easy adjustment, man. I love this city.
Good wineries out here in this, this neck of the woods.
Good wineries, and just continuing to adapt. I think being out here, you know, 5 years now, I found my restaurants. I know where to eat at. I know where to go. And having purchased a home, I'm happy and content with, you know, the lifestyle I live and my day-to-day impact in the community and how I can continue to become a better person. And I think that coming from Canton, Ohio, the Midwest culture of, you know, work for everything you want in life and this kind of blue-collar mentality with a lot of, steel workers and stuff like that. My dad coming from the steel mill, but just understanding that I've come a long way and that I still have a long way to go.
Have you felt more emboldened over the last few years as your game has come along to be more vocal with the front office about the types of players that would, because everything's kind of built around you two guys, like trying to find the talent that fits, you know, the two stars of this team. Do you talk more, or have you talked more over the last few years with the front office about the type of guys that might fit?
Yeah, I think we communicate. We have, like I said before, open door policy. So I'll slide in Neil's room from time to time or Billy's room and just kind of, you know, talk to them. Maybe it's just about the season, how the season's going, how I'm feeling, or some new wine that's out that they should try, or my happy hour spot. And then other times it's more about, you know, certain players that they feel like would fit our mold or fit our culture. And I think that it's important that they bounce stuff off of us and we bounce stuff off of them if there are particular questions. And they've been great with keeping us involved in potential targets and potential players they think can help us.
Still a Browns fan. That's
forever, man. It's got, life.
Never thought about switching allegiances.
I have thought about adding another one.
Adding one. It's kind of hard. Once it's ingrained in you, right?
Like, yeah, I've been to Seahawks games, and Richard Sherman looked out for me and got the tickets. Happy to see him progressing and moving along in his career, but. I almost adopted the Seahawks. I've been close to adopting.
That's fair, though. If you're playing in a market, like, that's you can never give up.
I'll go to Seahawks games, but I'm a Browns fan.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is.
It's not like when I left Boston for New York, I couldn't become a Yankee fan.
I like the Yankees. I go to Yankee games.
You go to Yankee games? Going to games is fun, though. Going to, like, a Yankee Stadium.
I love New York because of the fact that all my alumni are there. So they always take care of me and give me Yankee tickets.
Now, do you have the same feeling? A lot of road guys come into New York and say the Garden is their best, their favorite road arena to play at.
I like it from perspective of the fact that it's the Garden, all that history, you know, the celebrity role and everything. But I like playing in Ohio because you know, family gets to see me for, you know, one game a year in person. And then I also like playing in, where is that at? I like Staples Center because of the, you know, the history of Kobe. Kobe obviously being one of my favorite players of all time. Staples Center. Then, believe it or not, I always shoot well. Well, up until this year, I shot really well in Sacramento. And there's another city. I like playing in Toronto because there's always great fans.
Do you learn something from Kobe? Did he ever, I mean, something you took away from Kobe over the last few years?
Just his work ethic and his approach. You know, sacrificing, you know, a lot for this short-term period in our lives to where maybe it's a 10-year career, maybe it's 15. If you're lucky, you know, some of the, you know, five players have had a 20-year career. You sacrifice now, and it seems like a lot, but then you retire as an old basketball player but in a young human being, as a young man, and you have so much left to live for. So you sacrifice, you know, sleep or whatever the case may be, nights out or travel right now and make the best of this moment. And then you have no regrets when you retire in your mid-30s or late 30s. You can go on and do all the things that you didn't do while you played.
Well, you'll be in journalism anyway, right? You'll be on that TNT set. You'll be doing. You're good at this stuff. You'll be. I've seen you on those broadcasts.
I appreciate it, man. Just trying to diversify the portfolio and build my resume so that I can, you know, figure out what the next move is.
If you weren't going to play in the NBA, what do you think you'd be doing?
Besides just stay at home, dad. Hmm. I would definitely be involved in journalism. I haven't had the background of being involved in journalism, majoring in journalism, mm-hmm. working with the Players Tribune and ESPN and NBA TV and all those outlets. I'd be involved in journalism for sure because I love sports. Mm-hmm. I love to talk about sports. I'm not sure what else I would do. Maybe I would creep around different organizations and maybe get into scouting a little bit just because I like evaluating talent. Mm-hmm. But then that would kind of mess up my journalism, give me a little mm-hmm. bias.
Has your perspective changed on, you know, post-playing career? Not that you have to think about that for a while, but, yeah. you know, and do you want to get into front office stuff? Do you want to get into media more? I mean, have you thought about that?
I'll definitely be involved in media, maybe create another media outlet because I have the Young Journalism Mentorship programs right now and mm-hmm. continuing to build CJ McCollum Dream Centers all across Oregon and then eventually the United States. But I don't know if I want to be all the way involved with the NBA team just because I don't want to travel as much when I retire. But I could definitely see myself taking on more of a Steve Nash or Kevin Garnett role where I'm maybe a consultant for a team or maybe I'm working with players, mm-hmm. you know, here and there, working on pick and rolls or pull-ups or has he threes or just bad shots in general. If they want to work on mastering bad shots, I'm here for them. But besides that, I don't as of right now, no kids, I'm not married yet, so once all that happens, and that kind of changes your life trajectory and how much you want to be at home.
KG's got it wired, right? I mean, he just pops into camps periodically, goes on TNT. That exactly. seems to be the right, it's that's the right gig.
So you get to go home and be with your kids and your wife and whatever. And then you get the balance of being able to still be around the game, still, you know, be involved in the media world mm-hmm. while working with a team. So you get a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, CJ, good luck with the Browns, man. And more importantly, good luck to you the rest of this season. And thanks for joining me.
No problem. I appreciate you having me.
That's it for this week's episode. Thanks to my guests for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.